Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs Hate Violence Audio Press Conference. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. Thursday, May 31st, 2012. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Igeris Dixon. Please go ahead.
Good morning to those on the West Coast, and good afternoon for the rest of us. My name is Igeris Dixon, and I'm the Deputy Director in charge of community organizing and public advocacy for the New York City Anti-Violence Project. I would like to welcome you all to the audio press conference for the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs' latest report, Hate Violence Against Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, and HIV-Affected Communities in the United States in 2011. We thank you for joining us today on this critically important call. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, or NCAVP, is comprised of 41 locally based LGBTQ and HIV-affected specific anti-violence organizations, and is coordinated by the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Local anti-violence programs provide advocacy, community education, and organizing, and a variety of services and support to LGBTQ people impacted by violence, whether it is hate, bias-motivated, sexual, intimate partner, HIV-related, or police violence. And all too often, our survivors face a combination of multiple forms of violence. 16 local anti-violence organizations reporting from 16 different states submitted data for this 2011 hate violence report. Last year, we implemented a new data collection strategy developed to capture as much individual data as possible in relation to hate violence victims, survivors, and offenders. This individual or person-level data allows us to analyze specific trends in hate violence in 2011 and specifically which communities are most impacted by various forms of violence, and how does police response vary across LGBTQ identities. As a result, in addition to the local aggregate data, the 2011 report analyzed data on 1,079 individual survivors of violence, thus creating significant insights in anti-LGBTQ violence. By analyzing the experiences of these 1,079 individuals, NCAVP can now document which LGBT communities were more likely to face severe violence. This person-level data gives policymakers, first responders, and LGBTQ communities a comprehensive depiction of anti-LGBTQ age hate violence. Hate violence incident data provided to NCAVP in 2011 reveals a 16% decrease in hate violence incidents, but an 11% increase in the number of murders. 30 murders of LGBTQ people were documented in 2011, the highest yearly total ever recorded by NCAVP. Among those reporting, transgender women, people of color, and youth and young adults face the most severe forms of hate violence. We have several speakers today from across the country that can speak to the diversity of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and HIV-affected communities. Our first speaker, Jake Finney, from the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center in Los Angeles, California, will be followed by Ms. Rot Ventimiglia from Equality Michigan in Detroit, Michigan. Then Rebecca Wagner from Outfront Minnesota in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Paige Dior, a hate violence survivor and friend to Dee Dee Pearson in Kansas City, Missouri. And Chai Jindasarat from the New York City Anti-Violence Project in New York. The report is available online and can be accessed at www.avp.org/ncavp.htm. I would like to introduce Jake Finney from the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center as the first speaker.
Thank you, Igeris. Hello, my name is Jake Finney, and I'm the manager of the LA Gay and Lesbian Center's Anti-Violence Project. As Igeris mentioned, in 2011, NCAVP documented 30 anti-LGBTQH murders. This is the highest number of hate-related murders recorded by NCAVP since 1998, and nearly half of the victims in 2011 were transgender women, but transgender women represented only 10% of the overall report. This shows a disproportionate impact of violence faced by transgender women, particularly transgender women of color, and it indicates the severity and pervasiveness of bias against transgender people in the United States. Although the total number of anti-LGBTQH hate violence reports dropped in the Los Angeles area, we recorded an 18% increase in the number of transgender victims. The majority of those reports were Latina transgender women. We know anecdotally that anti-LGBTQH hate violence, including murders, run rampant in many Latin American countries, and our clients come to the United States to save their lives. And we regularly work with victims to help them adjust their immigration status and apply for political asylum. However, many of our undocumented clients still experience further victimization when they arrive in the U.S. In fact, the NCAVP report shows that undocumented individuals are 2.3 times more likely to be a victim of hate violence. We frequently see Latina transgender women, who are oftentimes Spanish monolingual, become targets for the most serious forms of hate violence and discrimination. For example, one of our Latina transgender clients reported violence and harassment in several different homeless shelters in downtown Los Angeles, including one instance where a security guard pushed her down a staircase. Last year, our transgender community was stunned by the murder of an African-American transgender woman named Cassidy Vickers, also known as Chase Vickers. On the evening of November 17th, she was shot in the chest by a gunman on Lexington Avenue in Hollywood. About a half hour later, another African-American transgender woman was the victim of an attempted robbery in the city of West Hollywood. During the robbery, the suspect fired a semi-automatic pistol at her that he missed and then fled the scene. These incidents sparked fear in the local transgender community, which has voiced concern about further attacks. The LAPD believe the same man is responsible for both of these crimes, but he has not been apprehended yet, and the case is still under investigation. These stories and statistics demonstrate the disproportionate impact of violence faced by transgender women, particularly women of color in the United States. NCAVP's report highlights a critical need to look deeper into the hate violence against transgender people. It's crucial that we advocate for transgender inclusivity in our culture and to prevent hate violence, and we must also advocate for improved support and services by community and faith-based organizations for transgender people. Furthermore, state and federal authorities must take a more proactive stance in passing legislation and implementing policies that will prohibit discrimination based on gender identity. And they must also promote public safety, including the safety of transgender people. Thank you for your time. Now I'd like to introduce Nusrat Ventimiglia from Equality Michigan as our next speaker.
Thank you, Jake. This is Nusrat Ventimiglia, Director of Victim Services at Equality Michigan, based in Detroit, Michigan. As Jake mentioned, the NCAVP documented the highest rate of murders ever recorded by NCAVP members. Equality Michigan reported 3 of those 30 homicides, and all 3 victims were transgender women of color. This reflects our national data, where transgender people and people of color were disproportionately impacted by murder. 87% of all murder victims in 2011 were people of color, yet LGBTQH people of color only represented 49% of total reports. 40% were transgender women, while transgender women only made up 10% of overall reports from survivors. In Michigan, we also received 4 reports of attempted murder compared with none in 2010, 48 reports of physical violence compared with only 11 reports in 2010. This escalation in serious violence, which is also a reflection of effective outreach to highly impacted communities, can be seen in contrast with the FBI's preliminary statistics for Detroit and other cities in Michigan, which show a slight decrease in crime rates in 2011. The data suggests that, indeed, LGBTQH persons, particularly LGBTQ persons of color, are disproportionately victims of crime. More resources must be provided for prevention and response, acknowledging this reality. This is in a state where there is no recognition of anti-LGBTQ hate crimes, no protection from discrimination in housing, employment, or public accommodations, and therefore persistent exclusion from access to social and public resources. In October 2011, Shelley Hilliard was murdered in Detroit. Shelley was a 19-year-old African-American transgender woman. and we initially received a report of a missing person. In the course of searching for Shelley, we made a tragic discovery. Another transgender woman, her burned remains were discovered in an empty building in Highland Park, just outside Detroit. Days later, we received word that Shelley's mutilated body was also discovered. And then in December, Erica Hernandez, a transgender Latina woman, was killed. And the violence hasn't stopped. This year, we've already seen two more murders. In Shelley's case, two suspects were arrested, and as of today, both have pled to second-degree murder charges. Shelley's murder highlights the many problems LGBTQH youth face, particularly transgender women of color. Shelley was living at least part-time out of a motel and was engaged in sex work. Both of these facts made her more likely to experience the violence that ended her life. She was also well-loved and sought out the Ruth Ellis Center, a shelter and youth drop-in center in Highland Park. She was proactive in seeking and building community and could have benefited were more resources available, particularly those focused on housing for homeless LGBTQ youth. Shelley's experience highlights the importance of addressing root causes that increase LGBTQH people's exposure to violence, including shelter and housing discrimination, lack of education and employment, and barriers to having basic needs met. Were it not for our funding through Crime Victim Services Commission, we would not be able to do this work, so it's imperative that this funding is continued. We're the only LGBTQH-focused anti-violence program in Michigan receiving such funding, and one of the few in the country. Considering the higher rates of violence experienced by LGBTQH people, the importance of directing such funding for LGBTQH communities is incredibly important. I'd like to now introduce Rebecca Wagner from Outfront Minnesota in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as our next speaker.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Wagner, and I'm the Anti-Violence Program Director here at Outfront Minnesota, located in Minneapolis. This year's report shows us that people under 30 were 2.56 times as likely to experience hate-motivated sexual violence and 2.41 times as likely to experience physical violence. LGBTQH people of color under 30 were 2.06 times as likely to experience police violence, and youth represented the highest total reports of physical violence and bullying. Locally, throughout Minnesota, we received reports of multiple LGBTQ youth suicides, as well as a sharp increase in reports of school violence and bullying in 2011. This data and our local experiences clearly identify the need for policies and laws to protect LGBTQ youth and young adults from bullying, discrimination, and violence based on their identities. So next is Ajiris. Thank you, by the way.
Thank you. I would like to introduce Paige Dior, who is a hate violence survivor from Kansas City, Missouri. Paige, we are so excited, and thank you so much for joining us on the call today. We're very grateful to have you talking with us about the loss of your friend, Dee Dee, and the hate violence that you yourself have experienced yourself. Would you please introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Paige Dior, and I'm the transgender daughter of the famous baseball player, Satchel Paige.
Thank you so much, Paige. Would you like to talk a bit about your childhood experiences of growing up as a transgender woman?
My childhood experiences of growing up were very difficult because I was born into an athletic family. And by me being born as a man, my expectations were set very, very high. And so, but I was a woman born in a man's body, so it made me very suicidal, and I suffered a lot of psychological problems behind that.
Thank you, Paige. And will you speak to us about your friend, Dee Dee?
Yes. Dee Dee Pearson was a very good friend of mine. Transgender people are normally rejected from their own families, so we go out and create our own. Dee Dee was a transgender daughter of mine, and so I looked at her as if she was my own. And so when Dee Dee was killed on Christmas Eve, it was very, very devastating. Dee Dee lived a street life because she had nowhere else to go. She had hopes and dreams of becoming a better person, but it didn't seem to come out that way.
And Paige, can you talk to us a bit about losing Dee Dee and how that felt and what exactly happened to Dee Dee?
Well, as I said before, it was devastating losing Dee Dee. Dee Dee was killed by a man who thought she was a woman. Once he found out that she was a transgender woman, he shot her 6 times. And that was a hate crime.
Thank you, Paige. And would you speak with us a bit about your own experiences with hate violence?
Well, as I said before, when you're a transgender, you're rejected from your real family, and you have to turn to the street. So I had to go out to fend for myself, which was very, very hard. However, I've been shot at, kidnapped, beat up because I had no place to go, and I was out in the street, so I was vulnerable for those crimes to happen to me. I was born with a weak heart. I made an appointment to go to the heart doctor. However, when I was in the clinic, the security guards there beat me up, threw me out the clinic, dumped my belongings all over the street, and called the police on me. The reason of them doing that was that they said I was dressed inappropriately.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Paige. And What do you think needs to be done to end hate violence against transgender people?
What I personally feel that needs to be done is that if society can accept transgender, it would eliminate some of the violence. It's like we're a species that no one wants to deal with. We live a very lonely life because it's very hard for people to understand us. If we had services and food, shelter, and things that could help us, we would live a normal life like everyone else.
Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today, Paige. The voices of survivors of hate violence and the friends and family members of survivors are so critical to this report. Our next speaker will be Chai Jindasarat, who will speak to the report's specific recommendations.
Hello. My name is Chai Jindasarat, and I am the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs Coordinator at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. In this year's report, NCAVP is providing specific recommendations to policymakers and funders to respond to and end hate violence against LGBTQH communities. Specifically, we are recommending that policymakers end root causes of anti-LGBTQH violence by reducing poverty against LGBTQH communities and systemic homophobic, biphobic, and transphobic discrimination in laws, policies, employment, public services, and education. This year, we are recommending that policymakers and funders specifically address how discrimination, poverty, denial of services, lack of education, and criminalization contribute to violence and murder. We are recommending that policymakers end the culture that fuels hate violence by denouncing anti-LGBTQH statements, laws, and programs, supporting alternative sentencing programs to reform the behavior of hate violence offenders, prohibiting first responders and service providers from discriminating against LGBTQH survivors, increasing education and technical assistance on working with LGBTQH communities for service providers and law enforcement, and passing laws that prevent LGBTQH students from bullying, harassment, and violence in schools. We are calling on policymakers and funders to support data collection and research on LGBTQH communities, particularly data and research on LGBTQH communities' experiences of violence, to continue to identify its prevalence, the critical needs of LGBTQH survivors, and strategies to prevent and end hate violence. We are calling for an end to police profiling and police violence against LGBTQH communities by passing laws and policies prohibiting police officers from profiling based on race, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression, and ensuring that there are mechanisms to report and investigate police officers who are homophobic, biphobic, transphobic, and violent. And finally, we are calling on policymakers and funders to increase funding for LGBTQ anti-violence support and prevention. Broader anti-violence funding prioritizes funding for non-LGBTQ anti-violence work, and LGBTQH funders do not focus on violence as a priority issue, despite the continued documentation of its pervasiveness and severity. We are calling on policymakers and funders to recognize how critically important it is to resource LGBTQH anti-violence support and prevention, and to take action to support this work.
Thank you so much to all of our speakers. Now I'd like to open this press conference up for any questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, over the phone line, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. One moment, please, for the first question. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, to register for that question, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone.
Is there anything that any of the speakers would like to add as we're waiting for questions?
Yes, this is Chai Chinasurat, again, NCAVP coordinator at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. And just to finish, I'd like to add that this violence is more pervasive and deadly than people realize, and our community members are being killed on a regular basis because of who they are. In our report, we are providing specific and concrete solutions to address and end this violence through our best practices and recommendations. And we call on policymakers, funders, community-based organizations, and community members to join our efforts in any way that they are able to end hate violence against LGBTQH communities.
Thanks, Chai. We can pause again to see if there are any additional questions.
We do have questions over the line, and our first question comes from the line of Michael Lavers. Mr. Lavers, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Michael Lavers at the Washington Blade. Thank you so much for the call today. One of the concerns that I've recently reported on with regards to coming forward is that especially transgender women and undocumented immigrants are quite frankly unwilling to come forward to law enforcement for various reasons. So my question to folks on the call today is, what is NCAVP specifically doing to work with their affiliate organizations to address some of that reluctance to come forward and actually report what happened to them?
Sure. So I can start, and then other speakers, if you have anything to add, please jump in. I think from a national perspective, NCAVP members hold a best practice of always supporting survivor choices. So regardless of whether or not someone calls the police or wants to follow through with any kind of like charges or court proceedings, NCAVP members will support whatever choices survivors make. So it's important to kind of recognize that that's a fundamental principle of a lot of the work that we do. And what we're doing nationally to try and rectify those reporting barriers and the hesitation to report to law enforcement is that many of our member programs provide training and technical assistance to law enforcement so that when they interact with LGBTQ people, particularly transgender people, they do so in a culturally competent manner where they are being sensitive to the needs of that specific community.
Hi, this is Jake at the LA Gay and Lesbian Center. I just wanted to add to that, in our area, we have worked closely with the LAPD over the last 4 years in developing guidelines and policies for officers to help facilitate more sensitive interactions with transgender individuals since they are less likely to report and are also in fear of police many times. We find that our undocumented clients come from countries where you do not seek assistance or support from your local law enforcement agency. Your local law enforcement agency is an entity that is feared. With the LAPD, they just in April released their transgender guidelines and policies and are just beginning to implement those, and they are have some precedent-setting guidelines contained in a format that's been disseminated to other law enforcement agencies and to the press, and we're hoping that other law enforcement agencies will look to these guidelines and implement them in their own jurisdiction. We've also provided training for LAPD for the last 2 years, and we've probably trained over 1,000 officers at this point, which is just the tip of the iceberg. We look forward to continuing transgender training with those individuals and also in their jail division. Thank you.
This is Nisrat from Equality Michigan in Detroit. I'd just like to add that here locally, part of what we're doing is making sure that we increase our outreach to the transgender community and more impacted communities in the first place to make sure that the crimes are at the very least being reported to us and so that we can document them. And then if you know the survivors do wish to carry forward and carry forward with that complaint through law enforcement, we do facilitate that and act as liaisons between officers and the survivor. We also do trainings as well in collaboration with other community partners, including the State Department of Civil Rights, focusing on hate crimes and cultural competency. We are doing these around the state, and a big part of trying to get this work done is building these coalitions to accomplish the work because, you know, as we see the rates of crime continually increase and the rates of violence continually increase, our capacity is not increasing at the same rate. We're not being provided new funding sources, so that's certainly something that needs to be addressed. We're also bringing in federal law enforcement partners where we can, so people are aware that where there is a pattern or practice of abuse at the hands of local law enforcement, that they have another avenue of complaining if they wish to do so.
Great. Is there anything that any other panelists would like to add? If not, we can go on to our next question.
Perfect. Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Lisa Leff. Ms. Leff, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for organizing this call. It's providing a lot of really useful information. I have two related questions about the 30 documented murders. The first is, how confident are you of whether or not this number from the various sources you use is capturing most of the anti-LGBTQ murders that have happened last year? And then the second related question is if you know how many of those were dealt with as hate crimes by law enforcement.
So this is EJ Sixon from the New York City Anti-Violence Project, and our report represents the amount of survivors or the amount of murders that have been reported to us or we've seen through the media. So we feel pretty strongly that we have not captured the complete amount of murders because there's lots of times murders of transgender people are underreported by the media, and then it also revolves around community members or survivors or family and friends reporting to NCAVP. So we know that what we are documenting is probably the tip of the iceberg. We also do a report alongside this report of what we call the narratives, which are the stories of the victims of murder for 2011. A lot of those investigations are currently in progress. So what we can do is to get you more information and speak more in depth about how many we know right now are classified as hate crimes, but a lot of them are currently being investigated for a hate violence classification. I don't know if any of the other panelists would like to speak specifically about murders that they worked on in 2011 that got bias crime classification.
Hi, this is Jake from the LA Gay and Lesbian Center.
Hi.
And our experience, and this is not just last year, but in prior years, it's oftentimes difficult to have law enforcement or prosecutors classify or press charges on a hate crime, or a hate crime enhancement, actually, is what the terminology is here in California.
Yes.
What we find is that they're generally dropped or pleaded down, or even getting law enforcement to classify something as a hate crime is very difficult. The issue with law enforcement is that oftentimes they don't want to have a detective or an officer who doesn't want to classify it as a hate crime. Oftentimes they miss the nuances of anti-transgender bias statements that can be made by a perpetrator. They also, in certain jurisdictions, they don't want the stigma of having hate crimes. So a lot of times, for example, a particular city might feel stigmatized by having media report a hate crime happen there. So sometimes there's pressure on law enforcement to not classify hate crimes as hate crimes.
Really?
So that's where advocacy on our organizations is really important, to help ensure that those incidents are being classified appropriately.
And this is Chai, again, NCAVP coordinator at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. And the only thing I would add to those great points is that you can also look at our data generally about overall reports. And what our overall reports show this year is that only 55% of the survivors who did report to the police received a bias crime classification. So we do know that there's still a lot of work to be done to support these incidents of violence as being identified for what they are. And also, just the last thing to add about whether or not we feel that we're capturing all of them, I would just echo what Ijera said. I think from a national perspective, there are incidents, and I do get calls from folks from around the country and the U.S. territories about murders that are happening that unfortunately we couldn't include in the report and in the murder narratives because either a police report was never taken, there was no media report on it, and the circumstances of just how severe the family and friends didn't want people to know about it and didn't want people to know about their LGBTQH identity prevented them from ever coming to light.
Yes, to follow?
Oh, certainly.
Thank you. So and specifically for transgender women, is the issue in terms of perhaps the media not reporting it or law or whatever, the information that needs to come out that the victim was transgender and that was likely a factor in her murder, is that a function of, I didn't keep it, maybe either the family is not wanting that to come out? Is it a fact of, like, there's initially, okay, you know, we have a murder victim and they might initially identify her as biologically male and so then it never comes out? That it was. I know we had something like an issue like that here recently in Oakland where the police were identifying the victim as biologically male even though you know, she lived as a woman. So is that why you think maybe they're not getting the attention that would let you know that they actually happened?
This is Nisrat from Detroit. We
hi.
Had a similar situation here with, you know, some of the difficulties in identifying these crimes and or identifying homicides is that you're left to talk with, you have a report to look at, you're left to talk with survivors that are friends, family, or police who are investigating, and everyone has either a piece of the picture or has maybe a fragmented understanding of the person's life in some cases, particularly in relating to family who may or may not have been affirming and accepting. But, you know, in terms of identifying these crimes, or in homicides in particular, when doing media sweeps, you know, we look for certain clues. You know, we look for unfortunately, in a lot of media reports, there may be inappropriate and poorly phrased clues as to whether a person, a victim of a homicide, may or may not be transgender. And so, you know, those are tipping points to finding that information.
This is Jake again from LA Gay and Lesbian Center. We've had a similar experience in the past where we've had a victim who's reported as male when actually that person was a transgender female, and in part is because maybe the reporter talked to surviving family who were unaware, as Ms. Rapp mentioned, not affirming of a transgender identity. And what happens is that that individual leaves their hometown and comes to Los Angeles, comes to the Hollywood area because they know they can live freely as their authentic selves. And so then you have this conflict about, well, what was this person's identity? Everybody who knows this individual now knows that she is a transgender woman, whereas the family is mourning their son, their brother, their nephew. And it really illustrates how important it is to promote acceptance of transgender people by their families and by their communities. And they don't have to necessarily feel like they have to leave and come to Hollywood or other cities and lose all their connections and maybe engage in sex work for survival or end up being homeless, which puts them at a further risk of violence.
I understand. Thank you.
Do we have any additional questions?
We do. Our next question comes from the line of Peter Castles. Mr. Castles, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I'm Peter Castles from the Edge Media Network. My question is, do the data include domestic violence cases, you know, within couples and so forth?
Hi, Peter. This is Chai from the New York City Anti-Violence Project. I'm glad you could make the call. So we actually have a separate report for intimate partner violence, and that will be released in the fall. And it's also a national report on intimate partner violence within LGBTQH communities in the United States.
Okay, thank you.
And this is EJS Dixon for the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Because hate violence can also happen within an intimate relationship, we do track hate-motivated intimate partner violence. And so in this year's report, about 5% of the survivors that reported to us faced hate-motivated violence from their intimate partner. And we also track bias motivation. And so intimate partner violence is the third highest bias motivation for the incidents that we tracked in 2011.
Thank you. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, over the phone line, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of Seth Hemelgraf. Mr. Hemelgraf, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the call. So, I'm sorry if this is in the report, but of those 30 murders, do you know how many people have been arrested and, you know, how many people have actually been convicted?
This is EJS from the New York City Anti-Violence Project. We can run that information for you. We don't have it right now because a lot of these incidents are still under investigation, but I can, if we get your contact information, I can get back to you with those exact numbers.
Okay, sure, thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Aaron Morrison. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Actually, my question got answered, but thanks for having the call.
Thank you. And then once again, ladies and gentlemen, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of Tia Robbie. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Tia Robbie from Okun Local. My question is just more about internal transphobia and racism within the LGBTQ organizations. I'm just wondering, and it sounds like it's great that you guys were able to reach out to each other organizations doing anti-violence work, but in addition to reaching out to the media and other like organizations, have you reached out to gay and lesbian organizations that maybe aren't doing this specific type of work in an effort to kind of educate and give some of these numbers to why it's important to be more inclusive? And also, I'm just wondering if you have thought about doing any kind of training or, you know, mass education to sort of make the internal movement a little stronger around these issues.
Sure. So I can be an initial answer for that. This is Chai from the New York City Anti-Violence Project, and I coordinate NCAVP. So to your first question, yes, we collaborate a lot with other LGBTQ-focused organizations and communities. And so one way that we do that is anytime that we see an incident of violence happen, we kind of we reach out to the closest local group that we think makes sense. And sometimes there's not a specific anti-violence organization, so that might be like a local PFLAG chapter, which is Parents, Friends, and Family of Lesbians and Gays, or different organizations like that. And then we also collaborate nationally with several LGBTQ age-specific organizations. And to your question about whether we are doing any types of training, yes, we do. Training and education is a large component of NCAVP's work and of our members' work. And specifically what we're doing within LGBTQ age communities is we present at conferences like the annual Creating Change Conference, which is sponsored by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And we actually this past winter had a workshop specifically looking at hate violence against LGBTQH people of color and organizing strategies to address and prevent that violence.
Excellent. Thank you.
And this is EJR Stixon from the New York City Anti-Violence Project. We also coordinate the National Training and Technical Assistance Center for dealing with LGBT survivors of violence. So that's for either LGBT-specific or non-LGBT-specific organizations, and we have a warm line where they can call us to learn more about how to better serve and support LGBTQ survivors of violence.
And just one final note on that. Thank you, Jairus. So with our National Training and Technical Assistance Center, one fundamental principle that we always provide with our curriculum and our education is information about intersectionality and the importance of not just looking at LGBTQH communities as one specific group, but as a diverse group of people and communities that have different experiences based on their race, their gender identity, their immigration status, their age, their ability status, and all those other things.
Thank you. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of Kate Sosin. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Kate from Windy City Times. Thanks for this call. I just had a quick question about, you know, at the beginning you said there's a decrease in hate violence and an increase in murders. And I was wondering what you thought that might suggest and if you have any sort of anecdotal evidence about the trends in violence.
Sure. So again, from a national perspective, Chai again, NCAVP coordinator at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. What we were hearing from members when we first saw this data, and we reached out to members to ask them, you know, why they thought that the decrease happened. We don't feel that it's actually a decrease in violence. We feel that it's a decrease in reports and also a decrease in our members' capacity to do outreach and to advertise their services, which would drive reports to their organizations because of a couple factors, one being that it takes a lot of capacity to respond to murders and to that type of severe violence, much more than kind of ongoing advocacy with a survivor of violence. Because of the economy, most of our member programs have not grown since the recession, and in fact some are still losing staff, which puts them in a position so that they're only responding to violence and not doing a lot of proactive outreach because of those conditions. And any other speakers who'd like to speak to that, I'd open it to you as well.
This is Nisrat from Equality Michigan in Detroit. We certainly have seen that here locally in our state. We are a small staff, and the organization has lost some staff members, including those who assisted with outreach, communications, so we had, you know, we did see a slight increase, a very small increase by just two people from last year to this year, but a huge increase in violent crimes, and we would have expected to see a larger increase overall, but because we, you know, are responding to a 336% increase in physical violence and a 1,500% increase in reports of sexual violence, and obviously three homicides, that really, as Chai mentioned, that takes a lot of our resources and attentions, that we are, you know, forced to kind of be a bit more reactive than we would ideally like to be, just so that we can respond to this increasing violence. And so reports of harassment, discrimination, you know, we don't get those as much and aren't able to respond to those as often.
Do we have any other questions?
We have no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to you.
Is there anyone else, any of our speakers, who have anything that they would like to add, just in closing? Great. So thank you all so much for attending our press conference, Hate Violence Against Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, and HIV-Affected Communities in the United States in 2011. We hope that you all get a chance to read the report and utilize this critical data. Again, it is available online at http://avp.org/ncavp.htm. And you can also visit us at www.avp.org. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that please disconnect your lines.